From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. One out of four Baltimore residents lives in a neighborhood without a grocery store. Why is it so hard for some city residents to access affordable and nutritious food? Eric Jackson of the Black Yield Institute and Madeline Hardy, a senior at Goucher College, explore the issues of food justice in their documentary, Baltimore's Strange Fruit. Jackson points to the generational disenfranchisement of African Americans who were shut out of benefiting from the agricultural economy.
People who grew food, who actually were enslaved for the purpose of building this economy, are the same people, fast forward generations, are the same people who are trying to figure out how to access good food from the earth.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Baltimore's Planning Department, Health Department, and the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future issued a report on Baltimore's food environment early this year. The report describes where people buy food and what they buy. It also notes the neighborhoods where healthy options are severely limited. These places were once called food deserts. Now they're known as healthy food priority areas. About one out of four city residents lives in a priority area, low-income neighborhoods where more than a third of households do not have a car and where the nearest grocery store is more than a quarter mile away. Three times as many Black residents live in healthy food priority areas as white residents. Why aren't there nutritious options for food in every neighborhood in Baltimore? How does the lack of affordable and healthy food impact the quality of people's lives? Eric Jackson of the Black Yield Institute is tuned to these issues. He's about a third of the way through his Open Society Institute Baltimore Fellowship, which he's using to establish the Building Black Land and Food Sovereignty Practice. Jackson is also co-director of the new documentary, Baltimore's Strange Fruit, a story of food apartheid and the struggle for sovereignty. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thank you for having me again.
And also with us is Madeline Hardy, a senior at Goucher College and co-director of the film Baltimore's Strange Fruit. She's studying communications and environmental studies. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, why make this film?
Well, last time I was on the show, we talked about food apartheid and its need to be a part of the conversation.
Define food apartheid.
So food apartheid, in simple terms, is the systematic destruction of self-determination of Black people to control their food environment, and that results in high levels of mortality and morbidity. And it entails the reality that race and class has a key component in who has access to food and what kinds of food are available in those food environments.
So I interrupted you. You said the need for food apartheid to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, because not having it a part of the conversation is problematic because we don't get down to the root causes. We know that in Baltimore City, and the data doesn't shed light on this explicitly, so we pulled out the numbers and did some math ourselves. And we know that based on the 2018 Food Environment Report, 84% of the people who experience food apartheid in the city are Black people. And if we are not clear about that, then our solutions will follow the lack of information or lack of analysis that lifts up race and class as a part of that. And so we're interested in lifting up this language so that as we lift up food apartheid as the problem, that our solutions will go to building power amongst Black people rather than just having access to healthy food. There are many problems that are being solved that give people resources but don't build power.
How did you get involved in this project, Madeline?
Yeah, so I actually met Eric. He was speaking at a food justice panel at Goucher, where I'm a student. And so I approached him after he was speaking. It was the first time I had ever been introduced to the term food apartheid, which my background's in environmental studies. So these are concepts that I've learned about academically, but I've never heard such a incendiary term be attached to something that I'd been studying. So I approached him afterwards and mentioned that I was an aspiring documentary filmmaker. And he actually believed me and wanted to work together. And we actually made a film happen.
And how long ago was that you started the film?
That was over a year ago now. It was a process because I went abroad. I did a semester abroad, and Eric had some life events going on. So we were playing a little email back and forth for a long time, but we never let the project die. And then in, I guess it was May of last year, we finally sat down in the same room together and started mapping this thing out.
The film makes clear that the term food desert is not the best way to describe the lack of access to food. What's wrong with that term?
I mean, when you reflect on the term food desert, a desert is something that occurs naturally, and it doesn't really highlight the man-made nature of food apartheid, which is what people are actually experiencing in Baltimore City and in cities across America. So food apartheid directly forces you to confront that it is something caused by systems and structures that have been perpetuated and that need to be undermined directly, as opposed to a food desert. How do we approach a food desert? So getting honest about talking about what the problem is and in how we name the problem is the first step in actually solving the problem.
What do you think of the descriptor healthy food priority areas?
We think, from the perspective of Black Yield Institute, that term pushes the envelope in a different direction than we've publicly pushed the conversation. I would say personally that it is at best an attempt to have an asset-based view on food inequities. And I have to say it's a Pollyanna term. Healthy food priority areas are aspirational at best. However, they do not speak to the underlying power indicators, again, around race and class, that literally is killing people. And healthy food priority area doesn't speak to the seriousness of this problem that is entrenched through policy, through practices that create it. And so I think it's a step back.
That's Eric Jackson here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He and Madeline Hardy, who's also with us, just made a documentary called Baltimore Strange Fruit, which explores the intersections of race, food, land, and class. This is on The Record on WYPR. Eric, you have a background in social work. When did you make the pivot to focusing on food access?
The social work profession, as I like to talk about it, as really the profession of being human, explores all systems and behaviors that those systems create for human beings, which includes our food system. And so as a social work practitioner, as an organizer, and as an educator, I think it's all tied. Food in and of itself, if you do not have access to healthy, affordable food, and if your community does not have what it needs to thrive economically, politically, and socially, then you can't be fully human. And so as far as I'm concerned, what I do on the day-to-day as the servant director of Black Yield Institute is social work. It is as social work gets. And as far as I'm concerned, and especially one of the contents and characters in our film is to humanize food apartheid, and through the lens and story of my grandmother, she was one of the first social workers I saw, even with a third grade education. When you talk about understanding human dynamics and you understanding and having compassion on people, no matter their life situation or their walk in life, it is social work. And so as far as I'm concerned, food equity work is social work.
Your grandmother left school at third grade and grew up poor, but her family still ate well.
Yes. Yes. So my grandmother, I found out, and I didn't learn this until after she was long gone. She passed December 21st, 2000. In 2017, a year ago, I found out more about the generation before my grandmother. And in doing that research, I found that her parents and their parents were sharecroppers. They grew food, so they always had food. They were poor, but they were poor in rural Towson in Baltimore County. And they always had food. My grandmother and most of the women in her family on both sides, the Briscoe and the Bowling family, they worked in domestic work. My grandmother did domestic work for most of her life, and she had food, right? I mean, she knew how to prepare food. She knew how to grow food. Even growing up and raising children in Cherry Hill in the 1960s, she had a garden in the projects. So she knew how to grow food. She knew how to prepare food. So her poverty, as we say in the film, wasn't really an issue. It was the food environment that she was in that ultimately caused the challenges that led to her having diabetes and then her premature death.
The film includes many interviews with people who grow their own food, both for themselves and as a business. Let's hear from Sasha Jones of the No Boundaries Coalition about her experience growing food.
You can celebrate putting a seed into a ground and watching it sprout 3 days later, just as well as you can celebrate taking that same food that you grew and making it into a delicious meal that other people enjoy. And you're still working, you know, and you're still helping to heal that disenfranchisement, because one of the things that I noticed as I started to grow food is just how much of a self-esteem builder it was.
Is this what sovereignty looks like, growing your own food?
I would say in part, but I would say sovereignty in terms of food is more about owning every single step of the food production process, from production to distribution to consumption. And so in part that does look like growing your own food, but that also means if you're not the person growing your own food, maybe you're the person that runs the co-op that distributes the food. So there's a lot of different ways that people can be sovereign without physically growing their own food themselves, but growing your own food is a part of that process, I would say.
We need to take a quick break on the record. When we're back, what historical context can help us understand the lack of healthy and affordable food in some city neighborhoods? We'll hear more from the directors of Baltimore Strange Fruit. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about food justice today. Here in Baltimore, one quarter of city residents don't live near a grocery store and may not have a car to easily get to one. How can Baltimore communities without grocery stores or farmers markets take actions to supply residents with fresh produce? How have African Americans been blocked from economic success in agriculture throughout history? The film Baltimore Strange Fruit, The Story of Food Apartheid and the Struggle for Sovereignty, tackles these questions. Its directors Madeline Hardy and Eric Jackson are here with us. Madeline Hardy is a senior at Goucher College. Eric Jackson is founder of the Black Yield Institute, and he's a 2017 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow. Especially in this last week with the opening of the Lynching Museum and Memorial in Alabama, many of us have heard the song Strange Fruit, recorded by Billie Holiday in 1939. In your documentary, Nika Namdi of the Living Well and Fight Blight Baltimore describes how lynching was used to take land from African Americans.
Lynching as a tool of terror was used to run black people off of prime agricultural land that we not only had gained after the period of enslavement or after emancipation, but also because, you know, of our agricultural acumen, we were doing well with that land in a lot of cases. And so you got white folks being jealous and saying, oh, well, we want that land. All right, they got this prime land. Okay, yeah, we're going to run them off.
How did you choose the title Baltimore Strange Fruit?
So we were going through the creative process and thinking about a title that encapsulated the tone and flow of the film while also being jarring when you hear it. And we were very intentional about thinking about the song performed by Billie Holiday, who is at some point of her life a Baltimore resident and from Baltimore, which we thought was fitting, and the play on words around strange fruit. The idea, particularly that Baltimore City, largely in the food world, is seen as an innovator, and Baltimore City still has its problems. And so we want to bring forth an issue that from the outside world is being told by the people who experience it, and lift up this language that talks about it in a way that officials won't talk about it.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Eric Jackson and Madeline Hardy about their new documentary, Baltimore's Strange Fruit, an analysis of food apartheid. The film will be screened on Thursday, May 10th, at the Baltimore Free Farm. Michael P. Scott of Equity Matters also points in the film to the later use of economic policies and laws specifically designed to disenfranchise black farmers.
You know, you had very few farmers that were able to make the transition to this larger, big agri kind of business that were communities of color or farmers of color. And, you know, big agri took them out. And not only that, whimsical land policies or the externalities, the unintended consequences of other policies, land use policies, taxation policies. Where do you put a landfill?
How do these policies play out?
Yeah, so with policies like redlining and other forms of housing discrimination and land displacement discrimination, even though that might have happened decades ago, the remnants of that and the ramifications of that are still playing out in the way the food system operates. And when you think about wealth building, if people are displaced from land in the early 1900s, if you think about generationally wealth building, how the family lineage, how they've been denied a certain wealth because of that initial displacement. So you have to think of the effects of these historical type of policies.
And those things played out on the rural and urban contexts. And they have ultimately taken people who literally built this country, the descendants of enslaved Africans are the descendants of experts, people who grew food, who actually were enslaved for the purpose of building this economy, are the same people. Fast forward generations, are the same people who are trying to figure out how to access good food from the earth. And so these policies have favored, in rural settings, white farmers, especially those who are, you know, big farmers. Since the 1940s, policies after World War II that moved us toward the industrialized food system that not only gave people access to subsidies to grow crops like potatoes and soybeans and things of that nature, but also the taking of land for the purpose of research, for the purpose of growing food to feed the nation, which on the cover is a good mission to feed the nation. And underneath of that, we know that there are people who literally lost land. And we're talking about in Maryland and Virginia and North Carolina. And you can find out by doing research where, in fact, black farmers have sued the USDA for that purpose. It's documented. And so it's not something that we're making up. These are policies that literally have impact on farmers in the here and now, but also their descendants who were the same people who moved to the urban context. So we want to, with the film, connect that, that idea of lynching through strange fruit, of literally the unintentional or intentional refusal of land and food for some people is a systematic lynching, no matter how you see it. It's slower. It kills people over time rather than hanging from the trees, you know, the strange fruit that are hanging from the trees, as Billie Holiday talks about. But it happens through policy in ways that we can't always see because it's very much in a part of our backdrop, a part of our context, and it's business as usual. So we don't usually see it.
One of the themes of the film is self-reliance. You say that establishing a food pantry or attracting a multinational supermarket is not a long-term solution to food apartheid. Why not?
So these are Band-Aid fixes when you think about the long-term, in a long-term struggle for food sovereignty and independence and a constant guarantee that a group of people will always have access to food. A supermarket or a food pantry is going to be something that can solve things for the minute, but at the same time, that can always be taken away or removed if the market is no longer there or if the benefactor no longer wishes to place something there. Whereas if you have infrastructure that is developed from the ground up to grow food and distribute food, that is more solidly not going to be moved by someone in power making a decision to move that.
So food charity is great. And it's short term, as Maddie spoke about, because it puts people, the recipients of those of that charity, at the whims of those who are providing the charity. If the political will shifts, people stop having access to the resources, whether we're talking about philanthropic communities or we're talking about nonprofit organizations or other companies that, quite frankly, prop up capitalism and its imbalance. Self-reliance and food sovereignty allows for people to have access to land, to own land, and also access to those kinds of food retail and food projects that allow people to build for themselves. Resources and programs are not what people need. Power is what people need in order to make sure that generations of people have what they need.
Madeline, did anything surprise you as you were making this film?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the whole process was surprising. I've gotten to speak with so many people that I might not have met otherwise. I've been surprised by the reception, how many people have come out to see it, how many people have reached out to Eric and I and spoken good words about the film. So I'm surprised that I could finish a film during my senior year of college. So, yeah, surprises all around.
Well, congratulations on the film. I appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Eric Jackson, founder of the Black Yield Institute, is a 2017 Open Society Institute Baltimore Community Fellow. He and Madeline Hardy, a senior at Goucher College, co-directed the new documentary Baltimore's Strange Fruit, The Story of Food Apartheid and the Struggle for Sovereignty. On Thursday, there's a screening of Baltimore Strange Fruit at the Baltimore Free Farm in Hamden. Next week, there's a screening on Wednesday at Charm City Farms in Greenmount East, and on Thursday at Cherry Hill Urban Farms. The movie's website is BaltimoreStrangeFruit.com. We've got details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.